Welcome to the Fermi Podcast. I'm Andy Crouch, and I'm back with Gabe Lyons. Good to see you again, Gabe.
It's great to be with you.
Well, I did a very cool interview this week with Michael Lindsay. Michael is not someone a lot of folks have heard of at this stage, but I'm convinced he's someone that we're all going to have heard of by the end of our lives. He's a young sociologist who just started teaching at Rice University, who's had quite an amazing opportunity over the past 3 years. He's found a way to interview in depth, many hours at a time, well over 300 followers of Christ who are in positions of cultural influence in our country, in politics, in business, in entertainment, and the arts. And no one has managed really to get access to this wide a range of people and ask them about how their faith and their life as cultural leaders influences what they do.
It's a really important work. And I think what's impressive about Michael, Andy, I know you'll agree, just how humble he is. I mean, he's just one of the most amazing guys, period.
He is amazing.
And it's like God blessed him. You know, like he has that sort of character that allows him to do all the things that he does and just stay so humble. But he really is doing some groundbreaking work. And I think it really goes back to when you look at his last few years, you know, he's at Princeton University where he was able to apprentice under George Gallup Jr. Many people have heard of Gallup polls. George Gallup Jr. and him really spent a great deal of time together working on some things. And, you know, as a sociologist, you know, we don't hear a lot about sociology, Andy, but I'm curious what your take is on why would a church leader, why would a Christian care about sociology? What's the importance of that?
Well, you know, the thing about sociologists, of course, it's very hard to be a true scientist when you are dealing with human beings because human beings are just very complicated. But sociologists are like scientists in this way. They're serious about the data. And they have learned how to look at phenomena on the scale of a whole culture or a whole society and rigorously examine it. You know, a lot of us, and myself very much included as a writer and journalist, I mean, I kind of go around with a lot of impressions. You know, I have the impression that a lot of people have iPods now, right? But a sociologist always says, well, what's the data? How many people actually have that thing? We have this impression, as evangelical Christians often, that we don't have very much cultural power. You know, you often hear that we're a minority or that we have no access to Hollywood, for example. Well, a sociologist says, well, let's find out. You know, what's the data? If we start interviewing people and assessing this particular cultural domain, what do we find? So I think sociologists keep us humble. You know, you mentioned Michael himself projects an amazing amount of niceness for someone who's actually quite brilliant. But he keeps us humble because he just honestly reports what he sees, and he's been trained to do that in a rigorous way that most of us don't have the opportunity to be trained to do.
And so now let's go and listen to this interview you did with him, Andy.
Well, let's start by having you just describe how you've spent the last couple of years, where you went, what methods you used, and kind of a thumbnail summary of what you've discovered.
Sure. I was interested in trying to figure out how Orthodox Christians, people of deep Christian faith, who are also in positions of societal responsibility, so leaders in government, in the White House, cabinet secretaries, heads of federal bureaus and agencies, as well as business leaders like corporate CEOs and folks in Hollywood and professional athletes, how do they bring their faith to bear on what they do through their work? So does their faith make a difference in how they live their lives and particularly in how they exercise their influence in their different spheres of influence? And one of the interesting things I found is that it makes a huge difference. It not only grounds some of their convictions and shapes some of their motivations, but it can produce actual tangible results in lots of different parts of American society. The project was trying to interview a lot of folks who had been in responsibility over the last 30 years or so, and in total I interviewed about 360 leaders from lots of different walks of life.
And describe a little bit, you mentioned some of the different spheres that they were in, but Could you give us a sense of who some of these people were, if that's public knowledge or if you can?
Sure. I interviewed former President Jimmy Carter, former President George H.W. Bush, about 20 cabinet secretaries, and folks like C. Everett Koop, who was Surgeon General, to Karen Hughes, who was counselor to the president. I also interviewed about 40 Fortune 500 CEOs, as well as another 50 or 60 CEOs of really large companies, both public and private. So the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, the CEO of Hughes Supply, the head of Epcot down at Disney World, and Hollywood folks, so writers, producers, directors, folks like Todd Komornicki, who was the producer of Elf, Ralph Winter, who has produced a lot of different movies, X-Men, Fantastic Four, Scott Derrickson, who's director of The Exorcism of Emily Rose, as well as professional athletes like golfers Nancy Lopez and Betsy King, as well as football players like Kurt Warner and Tony Dungy, coach of the Indianapolis Colts.
Wow. You know, evangelical Christians, I think, in America can sometimes have a sense of being a beleaguered, persecuted minority, but when you list this number of people, it sounds like actually we may underestimate the degree to which people of faith are actually already in positions of cultural power.
That's exactly right, Andy. That if you look at it, I mean, there are leaders in very senior positions in American society who are very serious about their faith. I mean, if you have to estimate what percentage of the nation's elite are evangelical, depending on how you define that, we're still talking about a small number, 5 to 10%. But when you compare that with where things were 20, 30 years ago, it's extraordinary. Evangelicals weren't even on the radar map 20 or 30 years ago. And today they can be found in lots of important places.
And what would you attribute that change to over the past few decades?
Well, some of it's demographic shifts, so that one of the kind of key indicators of ways in which you kind of move up social mobility is through access to elite education, so going to places like Harvard and Stanford, Duke and Princeton. And over this span of time, these elite institutions have made a real concerted effort to draw a national student body that's represented from different regions of the country, different races, different ethnicities. And one of the unintended consequences of this is that people of different religious faiths have come to these kinds of schools. So Harvard has more evangelicals today than maybe it has had in 200 years, and that contributes partly. But at the same time, there's been a real concerted effort by evangelicals and other people of faith to try and bring faith to bear on positions of responsibility. So there's a lot more initiatives for folks that are in these kinds of positions. Programs to help emerging leaders, folks in their 20s and 30s who have real potential to do something significant if they just have the encouragement and the access and opportunities. And Orthodox Christians who have some of those resources have deployed them, have used them to try and help some of their fellow believers to get a leg up.
Hmm. Now, you said that when people arrive in these positions of cultural leadership, that their faith does make a difference. Can you tell maybe one or two stories of ways that you saw that happening in some of the people you interviewed?
Well, some of it comes from decisions about what you're not going to do or what you're not going to agree to. So there's an element that faith kind of compels you to give up some things. So I had a couple of folks that I interviewed who decided that they had to take a step back from their positions for a time. Karen Hughes, for example, decided that life in the White House was so demanding and that the requirements of her job were really taking a larger toll than she was willing to pay, and she wanted to be able to spend more time with her son while he was still in high school. So she decided to step back for a couple of years. Since then, he's gone off to college, and she's gotten back into the fray, and she's now serving as Assistant Secretary of State in Washington. Another guy, Gary Deschamps, was the number two executive at Cisco Systems. And he decided that there was a need to give up his position because he disagreed on moral grounds with a personnel decision that was made. And as he told me, you know, very few people would understand why he had done it or the events surrounding it. And he really won't speak publicly about all that was involved. But for him, to stay in that position was was an act of moral cowardice, and he had to get out. So some of the folks that I interviewed decide that they've got to make a change, downshift or readjust their priorities. It doesn't mean that they give up the experiences or the leadership, and really, in both those cases, they've had lots of opportunities since then to get back into the game, so to speak. At the same time, there are a lot of folks who have tried to move the ball forward to try and make a real difference through their leadership. And you can see this, for example, there was a lot of exciting developments that happened in the late 90s where evangelicals built together a coalition to try and lead the passage of the International Religious Freedom Act that was passed in 1998 by Congress, signed into law by President Clinton, which basically linked human rights and international religious freedom as a hallmark of American foreign policy. So now we produce a list of countries that do not support religious freedom, and we're able to name and shame some of those countries into changing their policies. It's been extremely effective. We also have looked at public agendas for trying to end sex slavery, human trafficking. Evangelicals have been at the forefront of that. So public policy, we can see some real adjustments. Also in Hollywood, I think we're seeing some real changes, that there's a much greater openness. Phil Anschutz is a business leader out of Denver who has the Anschutz Film Group, of which Walden Media is one part. They've been behind producing the Chronicles of Narnia series. That the first movie came out last Christmas. They're currently working on finishing up a film on the life of William Wilberforce and trying to bring some of their Christian convictions to bear through public media. I mean, those are just a couple of examples. There's lots of this kind of activity happening all around us.
Hmm. You know, you've mentioned maybe roughly four spheres that you've focused on, kind of political leadership, business leadership, athletics, and entertainment. I'm wondering if you have a feeling that Christian believers have been more or less effective in one sphere than another. You know, how would you compare how much people have been able to really influence these spheres in those those different spheres of culture?
One of the people that I interviewed is a guy named Al Sykes. He was the commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission in the early 90s. And he says, really what I was trying to look at is what he calls move the dial Christianity. Not a radical change, but trying to elevate the influence of Christians in public life. And my assessment is that the easiest way to do that in our culture is through politics. Politics is largely based upon voting a particular person into office, and you don't have the same kind of gatekeepers that you do, for example, in the artistic world or in higher education and the scholarly realm. You don't have the same kind of impediments that you do in the business world. So politics is the area where I'd say there's been the most activity over the last 30 years, and in terms of influence, or at least bringing faith to bear on public discourse, politics has clearly been the area where we've seen the most developments over the last 30 years or so. Today, I would say that there's less enthusiasm for that, or my sense is that there's less enthusiasm from evangelicals, the average person in the pew, that there's more excitement about some of the activities that's going on in places like Hollywood, where people of faith are trying to bring their convictions to bear on the goods that are produced, on the movies that are made, the TV characters that are introduced, the books that are published. I see a lot more activity today, for example, going on in Hollywood than I do actually in Washington, a lot more entrepreneurial activity. So if I had to kind of make a prediction of what I think we'll see, I think we'll probably see similar kind of developments that we've witnessed in the political realm, probably in the artistic and entertainment realm in the coming decades.
That's interesting because I do think that even a lot of Christians who have been very active in politics, it seems to have a sort of a high disillusionment rate. And, you know, one of the expressions that's used a lot in the world of Christians in political leadership is that politics is downstream from culture, you know, so that they're realizing we legislate in this environment that's shaped by other kinds of culture, and especially people who are paying attention to Hollywood. But it sounded like what you were suggesting is that we may not appreciate how much you actually can do by participating in the political process, and that it might not be good for us to give up on that.
That's right. I mean, what you're saying is exactly what I heard as I interviewed folks in the White House and Congress and in all over Washington, that those folks who have been there for 15, 20 years do kind of express a sense of disillusionment or frustration at the lack of progress that's been made. And I think you could say that that's true for a lot of folks that, who've tried to legislate some of their commitments across American society, that it's difficult to do. Politics is a game of compromise, and because of that, it's not easy to get a straight line from your belief and conviction into public policy. There's a lot of in-between gray area, which is tougher to navigate. At the same time, I do think that there's been a lot of forward movement. I look, for example, in my book talking about how you can see an abortion policy and opinions, public opinion about abortion. It's very different today than it was 30 years ago, and I attribute that to a lot of the activism that's occurred among Orthodox Christianity. In international relations and foreign affairs, for example, in the journal Foreign Affairs this fall, there was a leading article that said that basically evangelicals have become the conscience of American foreign policy. And I think that signals a seismic shift from what we saw in previous generations. And then finally, you know, with faith-based initiatives, the interesting thing is that a lot of the debate that's happened since the White House created the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives in 2001, a lot of debate has been about, is this, you know, breaching the separation of church and state? Is it problematic that the federal government is giving grants to religious institutions and organizations? The funny thing is that this has been going on for decades in terms of international aid. The federal government has given religious groups grants from United States Agency for International Development, for example, to try and support lots of different initiatives in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America. The difference is that it's come closer to home. It's now some of these grants are going to ministries and projects that are down the street and in our neighborhoods.
Right, right. You know, let's shift topics a little bit and talk about churches and how the folks that you talked to, who are people of pretty significant accomplishment and status, how are churches doing at serving these folks that you interviewed? And turning it around, how did you find they were doing in terms of finding a local church where they were committed to and connected with?
This is probably the most surprising element to me, because these are folks who have a lot of resources. They give a lot of money to different Christian causes, and they're, by and large, very serious about their faith. So I fully expected that most of these folks would be highly involved in their local church. And there are some exceptions to the rule, but generally speaking, most of these folks are not connected to the local church. They might be members, and they might attend regularly, but that's not where their heart and soul is. A lot of the leaders that I interviewed, frankly, are frustrated with the local church. They feel that pastors don't connect enough with the everyday working world of their parishioners, and so sermons tend not to be deep enough, they tend not to be real enough, they tend not to grapple with the issues that these business executives say that they struggle with day in and day out. How do you make a decision as a person of faith when you realize it's going to put people out of work, or it's going to radically change the local community? These are big, tough issues where they're not easy answers, and perhaps it's unfair to expect that pastors can preach an answer in 25 minutes or less, but I did sense a real hunger, a real desire for more authentic connection between the working world of folks in the church and those who are leading the churches. That said, I did interview some folks who are extremely loyal to their church. And when I asked, well, why are you so committed? Why are you so involved? Invariably, they said it's because they respect the senior pastor as a real leader, that they hold a senior pastor up as someone who can make tough decisions, who recognizes that there's a lot of complexity in leading an organization. And because of that, they sensed a heartfelt connection with their pastors.
You know, it strikes me that Christians, and maybe pastors in particular, can be have a kind of a black and white approach to power, which is to say, either when we preach about people in positions of influence, it's almost always as negative examples of the damage you can do with power, or we become so intoxicated with and maybe envious of and attracted by power that we just celebrate anyone who, for any reason, you know, has some level of success and accomplishment. And yet it sounds like what you're describing is that these folks who really were plugged into a church had a pastor who didn't have either of those extremes, but was more aware of the complexities that come with being in a position of leadership.
That's right. When you think about how the Bible talks about power, I think that the overriding message is that people of faith ought to be in the world but not of the world. And you have to keep in mind that when you're talking about human action, power and meaning always go hand in hand, and we ignore it at our peril. The Bible talks a lot about how we deceive ourselves. And I think one of the key ways in which we deceive ourselves is we don't pay attention to the really big, important issues. I can't think of the last time I heard a sermon about power. It's almost always, if we talk about it, it's in the context of stewardship and, frankly,
right.
Financial resources.
Giving your money.
Exactly. It's not talking about how do you steward the influence that you're given. And regardless of your station in life, all of us have a circle of influence where we can make a difference. At the personal level, and sometimes at the organizational level, just by introducing subtle things in the workplace or just by trying to be more present, let's say, in your local PTA or in your local community, there are definitely ways in which power can be exercised in a soft, gentle, loving way, but a way that makes a real difference. The Bible in the Old Testament had three kind of characters that were often described. They were the prophets, they were priests, and there were kings. And sometimes you would have a character who was two of those roles, but you never had somebody who was prophet, priest, as well as king. I mean, in fact, the only person in the Bible who's described in that kind of language is Jesus. And a lot of times what you're talking about where we become infatuated with power is where you have the priest trying to also be the king. Whenever you have a pastor who's actually seeking power, particularly seeking political power or worldly power, it's always a scandal waiting to happen. And I think that probably the most effective thing that we can do in the church is to help folks recognize that it's natural and human to seek power and to want influence, but we have to bridle that. It has to be channeled through, frankly, the gospel and the ways in which the gospel ought to change our orientation. It ought to be not just something that we bring into our life, it ought to radically transform our life. And I think that what we will see in the years ahead is that those leaders who are able to recognize that there's great opportunity, that there's real a real chance to make a difference by exercising secular power, by bringing their faith to bear on what they do in the working world, and yet at the same time recognizing that you have to do it in different ways and that it has to be bridled, that there has to be accountability, and that frankly the church has to speak out a lot more about what it means to be a leader as well as a deep follower of Jesus Christ.
Hmm. Well, one last question for you. You've surveyed the recent history of a lot of evangelical believers in cultural power. As you think about the prospects for the next couple decades, let's say, what are you hopeful about? What are you worried about? What's your assessment of the prospects for evangelicals and cultural leadership in this very pluralistic, complex culture that we're in?
Well, I would say that there's real opportunity. Power gets exercised through networks, or what we would call in the church community. We exercise our power by our ability to get folks together, by able to convene groups, by being able to create new ideas and new opportunities, and by having a wide enough outreach that you have kind of a cosmopolitan approach. I mean, that creative, convening, cosmopolitan power is where I think there's real hopeful signs that I see going on in the church. In that regard, I think that there's a lot of resources that we have within the church, not just from the biblical tradition, but also from the communities that we're part of, that can be encouraging and helpful as we seek to try and bring our faith convictions to bear on our individual spheres of influence. At the same time, we need greater accountability. We have to recognize that there are secularists who are really fearful of the Christian quest of power because they see it as a tyranny of the majority, where Christians simply try and baptize this sense that we're in the majority and so we're going to squelch out any minority dissent. Actually, if you think seriously about what the gospel has to say, Christians ought to be the ones who are speaking up the most for the least and the lost. And I think that that's probably the most tangible, specific witness that Christians who are in positions of responsibility can bear, is that I'm not just interested in serving my own interests, but I'm genuinely interested in the common good.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for speaking with us on the Fermi podcast and for sharing the results so far of your work. And we look forward to keeping up with you and to hearing more from you at Q in April as well.
Sounds great. Thanks, Andy.